how does the great story start? What set the hands of the cosmic clock in motion? What started the wheel a-turning? Initiated the spark of evolutionary fire that burns through every age, including this one? Those are big questions and abstract ones. And I have been around Brew long enough to know that abstract and unanswerable questions are not the bailiwick of many among us. We prefer questions that we have some chance of tackling effectively, problems we can solve, and mysteries that at least lean toward resolution, even if not anytime soon. We are, by and large, folks who live in mystery, but only begrudgingly so. And yet the experience of mystery, cosmic or otherwise, is a profoundly important piece of being human. Whatever else we may in fact be, the simple truth is that we are not omnipotent. We are brilliant, yet enduringly befuddled creatures. And in the absence of clear and present answers to all of our questions, we create stories that fill in the gaps. Myths that speak to truths the facts cannot explain. Each year at Brew, I choose a theme for a running series of sermons that spans a good portion of the church year, about one a month. And this year, I've chosen to look closely at a variety of creation myths from around the world. We'll look at that aspect of Hindu cosmogony where the universe is said to be created by divine play. We'll look at the difficult story in Norse mythology, which says that everything is created by the violence and downfall of everything that came before. And we'll explore many other stories, from Native American myths to the Big Bang. In every case, what we'll be looking for is not the truth or falsehood of the myth or the narrative itself. This isn't just an easy, simple opportunity for debunking or for the casual dismissal that rational minds sometimes offer up when presented with anything metaphorical. I mean, sure, we know people make up stories when they don't have all the facts. And sure, we know that this is what happens in societies that gives rise to creation stories. But I have said it before, and I will say it again, and I know it may get boring, yet the truth is that stories often tell us more about ourselves than the facts ever could. And in this way, fiction can actually be more honest than fact. Creation stories might not be true. They might not necessarily tell us who we are and who God is, but they do tell us who we think we are. How people over the ages and around the world have experienced their place in the world, and they tell us who we think God is, or how we have experienced that force that moves primordial mud ever onward toward the complexity and beauty and pain that we know this world to be. What we will be asking in this sermon series is essentially this: what does this story say about us? About the present world, about whom we are and how we cope. What does this story say about me? In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And the earth was a formless void, and there was darkness over the deep, and God's Spirit hovered over the water. Those words are perhaps familiar to many of us. They are, for the Judeo-Christian tradition at least, the beginning of the beginning. Genesis 1:1, in the beginning God created. There was a great emptiness and a vast darkness, and the Spirit of creation hovered there, ready to spring into action. And how the Spirit does spring. Little known among the numerous people who hear about the Hebrew Scriptures but do not actually read the Hebrew Scriptures is the fact that there are not one, but two accounts of the creation of human beings in Genesis. The first is embedded right in the middle of the whole 7 days of creation story. And in it, God sees all the plants and the animals she has made are good. And God says, "Let us make man in our own image, in the likeness of ourselves." And so God goes about it. And the text says, God created man in the image of himself. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. Did you catch that? I tried to read real slow. In this version of the story, God creates man and woman together. Neither above the other, neither before the other, both in God's own image. God creates them in God's own image, and at the same time, you who have in fact read the Hebrew Scriptures are probably scratching your heads and wondering, what about Adam's rib? Which is, after all, a legitimate question, because only a few verses later, near the beginning of the second chapter of Genesis, we get a different story. In Genesis 2, 5 through 7, we hear the following. At the time when Yahweh God made earth and heaven, and there was as yet no wild bush on the earth, nor any wild plant had sprung up, a flood was rising from the earth and watering the surface of the soil. Yahweh God fashioned man from the dust of the soil. And then he breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and thus man became a living being. And then the story goes on that God picks up his man of clay, and he sits him in the garden and makes for him a bunch of animals, and then to top it all off, he makes for him a woman out of his rib. And all the aforementioned soap opera-like craziness commences, and everyone gets kicked out of the garden, and Cain kills Abel, etc., etc. There are two stories. One, which makes no particular distinction between the genders, and one that has been perhaps the most overused case of gender stereotyping in literary history. These days, the drama and the discussion regarding these two stories focuses largely on those differences between the unified creation of the genders, both in the image of God, and the dissemination of woman from a sort of throwaway part of a man. These are important discussions. And I think these two very different concepts of the origin of women are terribly essential to our understandings of all sorts of things, including the role of women throughout, you know, the entirety of Jewish and Christian and European and American history. But for now, I'll invite you to take that disparity and talk amongst yourselves. If only because that whole discussion would mean a whole nother sermon series, read it properly. And what I want to focus on today, I want to get really specific. I want to go down to one piece of those paired Genesis stories that is often overlooked and that to me seems more beautiful and true than it usually gets credit for. That is the part where God bends down into the primordial goo, scoops up a ball of clay, and forms it into the first man. Now, we do not have a whole lot of experience with omnipotence, but I could still imagine that there are any number of cool ways that an all-powerful deity could go about creating just about anything. In fact, in the first Genesis account, God pretty much just speaks everything into existence. Poof! And there it is! God said, let it be done, and it's done, and it's good. It's the formula that's repeated over and over for oceans, for trees, for cows, and porcupines, and men. God said, let it be, and there it is. But in the second account, God quite literally gets God's hands dirty. God is not the big pulsating brain or the thundering voice, but the potter, bent down in the dust and the muck, creating something with her own hands. Creation doesn't just happen. It's a process that takes time and care and attention. The big guy doesn't just say, be, and we became. The mother of all didn't just produce us in a moment without a long gestation. And believe me, as a mother myself, I know it takes a long gestation and not a short declaration to get a person produced. In Genesis 2, humanity is not created, but formed. Not spontaneously imagined, but thoughtfully molded. And that rings so very true to me. It is a process that brings about the first man. And when God breathes life into this clay, God knows that she is breathing upon something she has labored over and has loved. Now, I took a pottery class once. And in the course of 10 weeks of classes, I successfully turned 2 bowls upon the wheel, neither of which was exactly perfect or uniform. I glazed the best of my 2 bowls in bright neon pink, and I gave it to my big sister, and you'd have thought I was giving her a mountain of gold if you were to judge by how proud I was of myself. "Look what I made for you," I said, with a big smile and an exclamation point. And it makes me proud every time I think of her using it. The other bowl I successfully made, I kept. And I serve crackers and rolls and stuff in it every time people come over, just so I can have the delight of saying, "I made that." Now, I could buy a much better bowl pretty much anywhere. That is the truth. I could even think up a marvelous design for a bowl and have somebody else make it, and it would be way better. But I love those 2 lumpy bowls of mine because I made them. Because my hands formed them. Because it was hard and it took time and effort, and I don't particularly care if they are lumpy because they are mine. And that's what I like to think of when I imagine God as a potter, bent over in the mud, forming hands and armpits and legs and toes and eyes and ears from out of the ooze. God the artist, clearly an infinitely better artist than I, molding something from the mush and giving it to the universe as if to say, "Look what I made for you," with a beaming smile and an exclamation point. A God that forms. And that is, incidentally, the meaning of the actual Hebrew word used in Genesis, to form, rather than simply to will something to be. This is a God with a deep connection to her creation, a God who is, in the deepest sense, the artist behind it all. Now, the idea of God as a cosmic artist is not unique to the Judeo-Christian myth. In fact, like many themes in creation narratives, it is repeated over and over and over through the traditions of various cultures. It goes back at least as far as ancient Egypt, where one of the most popular themes in ancient Egyptian art was that of Khnum, the ram-headed god, fashioning humans and animals out of the silt of the Nile on his great potter's wheel. Most themes are repeated over and over in different cultures for a reason. Usually, because they tap into something that's essentially true about the world, about the divine, and about ourselves. No matter how different our circumstances, our environment, and our technological advancement may be from that of the ancient Hebrews or the ancient Egyptians, we remain these rather lumpy, imperfect creatures continually being formed and reformed by forces so much bigger than ourselves. In the early years of the 20th century, religious leaders among our own forebears were trying really hard to reconcile their understandings of God and faith with the nearly irrefutable evidence of Darwinian creationism. This was not easy work. And those who would defend the wonder of evolutionary biology often found themselves labeled irreligious or unfaithful. But some people then and now found a way through that either-or science or religion, fact or mystery debate with poetry and honesty and truth. And one of those folks was Jabez Sutherland, the minister whose work we had as our reading this morning. In 1902, he wrote his most famous tome, The Spark in the Clod, A Study in Evolution. And in our reading, Sutherland uses the metaphor of God as the cosmic artist in a beautiful way. He says that all things, everything, evolution and plants and beginnings and endings, is divine improvisational art. because creation is a process, not a proclamation. We are eternally being molded, formed, and shaped anew. Because the artist never ceases to create, the artwork goes on. It shifts, adjusts, responds to everything else around it, becomes something new every time the artist presses the palm of her hand against the clay all over again. Sutherland wrote that the medium in which God works is all things, and indeed the medium itself is God. A fire mist and a planet, a crystal and a cell, a jellyfish and a saurian in caves where cavemen dwell, a sense of law and beauty, a face turned from a clod. Some call it evolution, I choose to call it God. Or, some call it God, you might choose to call it evolution. Whatever name you give it, it is magnificent and humbling and unimaginably complex, and it is never, ever over. It goes on. It is going on even now. Just as the true artist never stops evolving, this artwork will never be complete. Sutherland went on to say that showing a person scripture and saying, "Look, this is how God created," is like telling them a story about Michelangelo. But imagine, he said, taking them into Michelangelo's studio and to have them see the master's tools, his plans, his unfinished sketches, his work actually going forward. Evolution, he said, was a glimpse into the great artist's world studio, universe studio. Amidst his tools of nature, forces, and laws, his designs of plants and animals and worlds, his work done and being done. Here we are, standing in the very midst of Michelangelo's studio, surrounded by the creative forces that propel all things from the beginning of the beginning to this very moment, and that will pull all things onward toward the stretching future. Here we are, formed of humble things, of atoms, of molecules, of clay. "Look, I made this," exclaims the universe with wild abandon. And because the process never ends, it is indeed good.